And we're live. Okay, so welcome everyone. Now I will be re-recording the talk on the Sabhasava Sutta, which I gave this afternoon. Due to technical failure, personal incompetence, the talk this afternoon was not recorded, so I'll be recording it again. And I have an audience willing to put up with me for hopefully less than an hour. It was an hour this afternoon, but I imagine it shouldn't be much longer than a half an hour this afternoon. But we'll see. So today's talk was meant to be a sutta study group. And the idea is that we'll have a text and we'll use it as the base of our discussion. And the idea was that people would be open to offer their comments, questions, and opinions, maybe even disagreements, and interrupting me. So as opposed to a formal talk, the idea is that you have the freedom to butt in whenever you want, which is no problem. It's sort of a different format. And the idea is we understand that we're all mature enough to be given that sort of a luxury. Yeah, I was thinking of Diggums when I said that. I'm just kidding. I have faith in you. So, the Sabhasava Sutta is one of my favorite discourses in the Pali Tipitaka, which is this early set of texts, which I'll be taking the selections which I for these sutta study groups from. The reason why I like this particular sutta is because it gives a fairly comprehensive teaching on the way of life of a Buddhist, of someone who is following the path to freedom. So in many other discourses, the Lord Buddha might have been focusing on one aspect of the meditator's life, usually focusing on specifically on meditation, and often that's what you get from talks on Buddhism, is talks specifically directed towards the meditative practice. This one is quite comprehensive in a very short talk, which is of course one of the great gifts that the Lord Buddha had in teaching. He was able to sum things up very concisely, but at the same time cover the whole of his teachings, or give a very comprehensive teaching such as the Sabhasava Sutta. So just a few words on the title. The word Sabha is very easy. It means all. And it's a compound word, so the A in the middle is actually a long A, but in the text from the internet, it's lost its long A because it's been romanized, or however, it's the font doesn't support it. It should be Sabhasava with a long A in the middle, and so it's actually two words put together. Sabha means all, asava means, as it's translated here, taints. But why I'd like to talk about the title is because I don't quite agree with the translation of the taints, and so I'd like to give a little bit of explanation as to what I think would be a better translation of the word asava. And this is common among Buddhist teachers or Buddhists in general, is we have a hard time agreeing even inside our own minds on which words to use for which Pali or Sanskrit terms. And of course, I mentioned the word sati is such a word. Here, asava is one of the most difficult that we come across. It literally means something like inflowings or outflowings, and we're not even sure which one, whether it's in or out, based on the root of the word. Sava is from the verbal root sav, which means to flow, and the long A in the front could mean come, could mean go, it could just change it to not flow. It can mean many different things. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to go back to the etymological root, because we have general usage of the word in common everyday village speak, colloquial Pali, or Magadhan, which is the language that we commonly associate with Pali. And so we see it used in the Tipitaka in three ways. The first way is as something which is intoxicating. Generally, the intoxicating extract or secretion of a tree or flower. So, like here in Los Angeles, in California, we have these eucalyptus trees that somebody got this bright idea to import over from Australia, and now they've just taken over on much of the coast, or else they planted them up and down the coast, I'm not sure. And when you walk through them, you have this eucalyptus smell. It's kind of mildly intoxicating. I mean, you wouldn't get drunk from it, but this is the meaning of asava. It's this scent, this flowing, intoxicating scent. It's something which is kind of euphoric or is mildly intoxicating, at least on a mental level. So in this sense, we have the understanding of it, something as being something that brings about intoxication. And I think this is clear when we're going to get on into the Buddhist sense of the word. The second meaning of the word is as a discharge from a sore. So here we're talking about an infection. We have a sore or a wound which is infected, and it's discharging, or there's flowing out of it is this pus or this bacteria. This is the infection. And so we get the sense of flowing here as well. Asava is something that sort of leaks out or oozes out. It's kind of like something that oozes. But the important point here is the part that talks about the infection. So here we have two very powerful images, that of an intoxication or something that intoxicates, and that of a infection, something that infects. And so we have a picture of a fairly ugly sort of, or unpleasant sort of reality or unpleasant phenomenon, something that we don't want into our bodies. And this is when we get into the third, this is how we should approach the third definition, which is the exclusively Buddhist definition, and that is as something, just a second, as something which infects or something which intoxicates the mind. And so I would rather use a word like intoxication, though it's kind of nitpicking. The word taints would be fine, so we'll use it here. And this is a very good translation by a very well-respected translator. This is from the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's available in America through Wisdom Publications, Pariyatti, and so on. And so this sutta is talking about these intoxications or these taints, but sort of in a roundabout way. It's not specifically concerned with the nature of the taints, the nature of these defilements, these bad things. It's sort of talking about how we're to get rid of them. And so it's dealing specifically with the path of practice, which obviously is for the purpose of doing away with anything that in our mind that we might identify as being an infection. I mean, it's a pretty powerful image of our mind being infected with bad things. And I think we can all get a picture of what those sort of things might be. Same as intoxication. And I think intoxication is a little bit less obvious to us, because in many ways we enjoy the things that bring about intoxication. We enjoy pleasant sounds, pleasant smells, pleasant tastes, and so on. So often we lose sight of the fact that it's an intoxication, and it's something which leads us to an imbalanced mental state and the inevitable hangover, you could say. But as I said, this text is specifically talking about the path of practice to do away with these. And so the way of doing away with these is not what one might think, simply sitting and meditating. There's a fairly, comprehensive dealing of these, dealing with these states of mind. And so the Lord Buddha starts off by explaining them to the monks what he's going to be teaching, and he starts up by saying the restraint of all the taints. And this is just sort of a colloquial usage of the word. What he's really talking about, he gets into later, the destruction of the taints. The word restraint is just sort of setting the tone for them. When he gets into the actual discourse, what we really mean here is the destruction of the taints. And so really getting rid of these unpleasant mind states. We're not talking about simply repressing them, pushing them away for a short time. We're talking about actually changing our lives, changing the way we look at the world, the way we look at the things around us, changing the way we view situations and the way we view people, the way we view our lives, to sort of in a healthy way, right? In a sober and healthy way. These are two of the images that we should keep in mind here. So first of all, he says something very important, that the destruction of the taints is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and does not see. And of course, this is, I think, something that we come across quite frequently, and rightfully so, in Buddhism, that this is not something that you can intellectualize. It's not something you can pray for. It's not something you can wish for. It's not something you can believe that you somehow have as a birthright. It's something that you have to practice. It's something you have to actually look for. If you want to get rid of these things, there's work that needs to be done. And what is the work? You have to see. And what do you have to see? You have to see. It's kind of an odd statement here. You have to see wise attention and unwise attention. What it means is you have to be able to see the difference. You have to understand wise attention and unwise attention. And specifically, you have to use wise attention. And you have to understand what is the difference between wise attention and unwise attention. And these are, again, two very important terms in Buddhist terminology, yoniso manasikara and ayoniso manasikara, which are wise, rendered here as wise attention and unwise attention. Wise attention, it's really referring to a meditative state where you're clearly aware of the object as it appears. So when they're seeing, you're aware of it as seeing. When you're hearing, you're aware of it as hearing. When there's smelling, when there's tasting, feeling, thinking. This is really a sort of a core meditative teaching of the Lord Buddha. It's not something that I should really have to get explained in detail. I think most of us are pretty aware of this. But it's worth noting that this is basically all we're expected to do in Buddhism. As the Lord Buddha taught, bahiya, it's a very famous disciple of the Buddha, and it's a very famous teaching. Bahiya was a man who thought he was an arahant. And why did he think he's an arahant? Because he went around naked. How it happened was, first of all, he didn't think he was an arahant. He was just walking around. He was shipwrecked, and so he had no clothes, and he put on a piece of wood. He just wore a piece of wood around or something like that. And so other people thought he was an arahant. Oh, look at this guy. He refuses to wear clothes. Must be an arahant. And after a while, he started to think he was an arahant. He sort of got this idea, and he was kind of proud. And people brought him, offered him clothes, and he refused to take them because he was afraid that he would lose all the gains that he had acquired. And then he was reminded of by one of his old friends that he was not an arahant, and so he went to see the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha for a very brief teaching. And the Lord Buddha said, well then, let it be like this. When you see something, let it be only seeing. When you hear, let it only be hearing. When you smell, let it only be smelling. When you taste, feel, and when you think, let it be only that which you have sensed. Let it only be the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. And he was able, just by listening to this and by reflecting on it and practicing according to the wise attention here, to become enlightened. So really gives us a view of what real enlightenment is. It's not something mystical or magical or esoteric. It's really a very simple thing, and this is why it's sometimes discouraging to see people chasing after advanced or esoteric teachings when, you know, really it's a very simple thing. Reality is not that complicated. And in fact, as I've said before, it's the complication that leads to suffering. It's the complication, the making more of things than they actually are. When we have an experience, and rather than seeing it simply as an experience, someone comes and they yell at us, or they say things, or they do things that we don't like, and we fail to see it simply for what it is, as an experience, things coming and going. And for that reason, we do and say bad things and inevitably suffer. So this is what it means to have wise and versus unwise attention. Unwise attention is, well, here the Lord Buddha gives some more specific examples, as we'll see in the next section. So it's the rest of the sutta is split up into seven methods or ways in which we can, in our lives, come closer to this state of being free from suffering. And it's something that we can use in our lives and something that we should take as a sort of a guideline by which to live our lives. It's, as I said, fairly comprehensive. So the first one is the taints to be abandoned by seeing. And I've already gone a little bit over the seeing here, but here the Lord Buddha is going to give some specific examples. And if we go down to paragraph 7, we see how in paragraph 6 he's just talking about sort of giving a specific categorization of things which should be of things which a person does not pay attention to. In chapter 5, he's talking about what kind of person sees things wrong. It's someone who is untaught, who has no regard for the noble ones, no regard for meditation, no regard for meditation teachers. As I was talking about this afternoon, we all sort of know these kind of people. They're the kind of people when they see us meditating, they say, "Boy, what a waste of time that is," or at the very least, they say, "My God, I can't imagine how you can do that, sitting there for an hour, sitting there for any more than 10 minutes." They're the people who say it's a waste of time. They're the people who call monks lazy, beggars, so on. All of these things. It's these sort of people who, because of their disinterest in the development of the mind, they're so much more interested in physical things that they thus attend wrongly. They see the experience from the outside, from a very physical, object, conceptual-based reality, in terms of people, places, and things, and they're not able to see things in terms of their ultimate reality. So they come up with all sorts of odd recollections. They start thinking about the past, worrying about the past, fretting about the past, grieving about the past, angry about the past, craving for the past. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? And so on. And the same with the future. Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? And so on. And as I said this afternoon, it was, you know, there are some people who try to claim that it's somehow necessary to use the past in order to progress in your meditation. And the way it goes is, I can think of two or three ways by which people try to claim that the past, at least, is necessary. People do it about the future, but it's more common, I think, in Buddhism to talk about the past. The first one is this idea that remembering your past lives would somehow be useful. And one way people argue this is they say, if I could see all the mistakes that I did in the past, then I wouldn't make them anymore. I'd be able to see the results, and that would give me an instruction on how to live my lives. And I don't disagree with this. I think it would be incredibly useful to understand to see our past lives and to know who we were and what we did in the past. If it's in terms of learning a lesson, that's not exactly what the Buddha is talking about here. But I guess I'd just like to say further is that it's not in the end going to make you really and truly wise just because you understand the problems and the mistakes you've made in the past. There's nothing to say that you're not just going to make them all again. Sure, it could be intellectually instructive, but certainly not enlightening. And certainly makes it possible that by dwelling on the past in such a way that you could come to identify even stronger with a self, who I am, and so on, an identity. And then you want to know more about the past and so on. More about who you are and your identity, which of course we're trying to let go of. And the second way that people argue this is that they argue that it would give them great faith in the Buddha's teaching if they were to know about rebirth. If they were to know the truth of it, then they would be able to say, yeah, well, then that means that I really do have to practice meditation. If there's no rebirth, then I don't have to meditate. I can just wait until I die and then that's it. It really makes no difference. But if I knew that there was rebirth, then I would have perfect and absolute faith in the Buddha's teaching. And I guess I don't discount that either. I suppose it would give you some amount of faith on an intellectual level in the Buddha's teaching. But again, I can't see that as anything more than an intellectual sort of faith. And it's nothing compared to the faith which you gain from practicing meditation based on the present reality, based on coming to understand what's real, what's here and what's now, letting go of the past. Letting go of the future. And then the Buddha does something interesting here as well. He talks about the present moment, and he says, he is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So this is a reminder that it's not enough for us just to say that we're in the present moment. We're not worrying about the past. We're not worrying about the future. We're just living for the present. And it's sort of a denial of those people who claim to be able to live their lives in the present moment when they're clearly not meditating, they're clearly not aware, they're clearly not in reality. that even though they're not in the past or in the future, they're still falling prey to their likes and dislikes, to their mental infections and intoxications. And so when we practice meditation, we work hard to do away with all of these. We're acting on a whole other level, and this is the arena or the arena of mindfulness, of reality. But here, for someone who doesn't attend wisely, someone who attends unwisely, then all of these views of self arise. The idea that this is me, this is mine, this I am. Or the idea that there is no self, the idea that I have no self, and so on. And this is what I was talking about earlier, about how in Buddhism we don't have this view that there is no self. We don't encourage people to have this sort of a view. I mean, it's very much hinted at, but see, the problem with developing a view is then it becomes very much intellectual. And so the Lord Buddha put it this way. He never went around saying that there is no self, no self exists, or so on. Because then what it does to people is they say, well, then what's going to happen to my, what happens to myself? You know, what happens to this self that I thought existed? And they get all confused. And so it's not skillful, it's not helpful. So Lord Buddha put it this way. He said, look, monks, I tell you to do this. If you can find any view of self that when you hold on to it, it doesn't lead you to suffering, then I tell you to hold on to that view, to cherish it, to keep it as your view, and to take it up and live by it. And then he asked the monks, monks, do you know of any such view? And the monks, of course, said, no. No, we don't see such a view. And the Buddha said, no, neither do I. And so the Buddha said, well, then for that reason, O monks, you should regard all phenomena as not self. But he never went into the idea that we should hold on to a view, there is no self, or so on. And that's what he sort of says here, that it comes to be, I have no self. This self of mine does not exist, and so on. It still becomes an identification of me and I. It's only intellectual. It's not practice-based. And then he talks about fettered by the fetter of views. What happens to them? Well, then they are not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They're not freed from suffering. I think this is totally clear. Explanation of the Lord Buddha's take on reality. That it is the addiction and the attachment to these ideas of self, the ideas of me and mine, this is what starts the ball rolling. And so instead of seeing something for what it is, seeing it simply as an experience, seeing it simply as an emotion, simply as a feeling, simply as a sight, a sound, and so on, we identify with it. We say it's me, it's mine, and let it be this way, let it be that way, wishing for it to stay, wishing for it to go. And when it doesn't obey our command, when things don't go the way we want, then we suffer. Sometimes pretty terribly. So what about a person who does attend wisely? What do they attend upon? Well, besides the things I've been talking about, specifically, the Lord Buddha explains it in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And it's clear that in meditation that we're always focusing on these Four Noble Truths, where everything we encounter in our meditation is considered to be the truth of suffering. Because if we hold on to it, then that's what it causes suffering. And so we're always encountering the first two noble truths, the suffering and then the cause of suffering, with the goal as the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. And our path is, of course, the path which is leading to the cessation of suffering. So another important explanation of this teaching is, what are the things that we're supposed to concern ourselves with in the universe? Because we see that in the West, we're concerning ourselves with things like, well, nowadays they're getting into string theory and 11th dimensional reality, all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, trying to figure out how the Big Bang happened and so on. And the philosophers and the religious people talking about the past and the future, talking about the self and the soul, talking about God and so on. And this, what we're reading here, is an important example of how the Lord Buddha's take on this. That really all that is necessary, or all that is proper for us to set our minds on, to put our attention on, is the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the cause of suffering, and the cessation, what we can do to get to be free from suffering. So this is what it means to attend wisely. This might take a little bit longer than I thought. So we're moving on. Please feel free to teleport out of here if you're ready to sleep. If you fall asleep, just snore quietly. So number two, the taints to be abandoned by restraining. And this is not only a meditation technique here, this one. This is also something that we're meant to use in our daily life. When we see things, to not immediately jump at them. When we hear things, to not immediately jump at them. And to sort of keep our senses guarded. And one of the teachings is often to, when you walk, to sort of look with your eyes ahead of you at the path in front of you. To not look around at the wonderful and exciting things that are happening around you. To really be focused on the task at hand. Focused on what's important, and not let yourself get carried away. And so it's not necessarily a meditative thing. It's kind of a way of holding yourself, and a way of living your life. So not chasing after pleasant sensations, going out to parties and bars and movies and entertainment, seeking after these things. This is kind of a sort of a preliminary exercise as well. But in the meditation practice, of course, it applies to everything I've been talking about, and it's obviously a very core part of the meditation practice, is because every experience that we have is one of the six senses. And so we're focusing on restraining, in terms of restraining the kilesa, the defilements which could arise based on these six senses. That's number two. I don't think there's a lot to explain about it besides that. So number three, the taints to be abandoned by using. Now this one is particularly focused on monastics. in the wording that it's given here, of course, because the Lord Buddha is talking to monks when he gives this talk. But I think if you read through it, you can sort of get a feeling for how perfectly applicable it is to our own lives. That even though we don't just have four things that we use, like for monks, there's only three robes that they wear, and they only have alms food in their alms bowl. They eat once a day. They sleep on the floor, even at the foot of a tree. And they have medicine, whatever medicines that they can gain, sometimes even going without medicine or using natural medicine. And so it's maybe hard to picture yourself doing all these things, but it's very easy to see what the point is. The point is that we are using them for a certain purpose. And once we read through this, we can clearly see that for most of us, we're not using these things for this purpose. It's not the only reason for wearing clothes. Our only reason is not protection from cold, from heat, and so on. And the purpose of concealing the private parts. In fact, it's often the opposite. Often it's for exposing or for amplifying or for suggesting or attracting people with our bodily parts. And actually the correct translation here is even stronger than private parts. The correct translation is those parts of the body that lead to shame, and it generally doesn't do that in the West. These body parts often lead very much in the other direction. And of course the idea is a very specifically Buddhist one, that our sexual organs are something that is developed based on our craving, based on our addiction to sensuality. And so there's something that is a sign or an indication of our incredible addiction as a species to sexuality and sensuality. So as meditators, we start to give that up and start to use these things specifically for what they're meant for, using them for a practical purpose, and not letting them become a cause for the arising of intoxication or infection, so that our mind is healthy and sober. And food, of course, is even easier to see. Food is something that is incredibly intoxicating. It may be difficult for us to see in an ordinary daily life. I think this is true because we have a lot of food, and it's pretty easy to get for many of us, and so we tend to lose sight of the fact that it's the one drug that none of us can kick. It's the one drug that we can never do without, because without it we know that we're going to die. And it does become a drug for most of us as a result of this, since it's something that we have to take in so often. We've come to develop and adapt it to be so flavorful and so exciting and so appealing. I give the example of Thai food, that it's always funny to hear people talk about when they hear I live in Thailand and I'm, you know, here in America, I'm going to for alms to the Thai restaurant every day. And they say, "Oh, Thai food, I love Thai food, you're so lucky." And I always think, you know, try eating it 365 days a year, and then we'll see how exotic it is. So we hold these things for their pleasure value, and we don't realize that it's really an addiction, and it's something that can really lead to intoxication and sort of infection in the mind. Lead the mind to become addicted. And you maybe don't see this really clearly until you actually start to moderate your eating. And once you take on meditator precepts, once you start to try to develop the patience of a meditator, patience with things like hunger and so on, which I'll get into the next sections, then you start to see how important it is to moderate these things, to use them specifically for what they're for and not overeat, creating feelings of glutton, of bloating, of overeating. And the same with our dwelling, the same with our medicines. These are perhaps a little bit more specific to monastics. With a dwelling, often it can be a cause for monastics to become lazy. So often we do go and live at the root of a tree, or live in the forest in a very simple dwelling, in order to do away with this comfort and luxury. But the important thing is that everything we use should be used for its purpose, even things like Second Life. Here we are in a virtual reality, and there's so many different things that we could do, so much potential. And people often mistake potential for desirability, or kind of like appropriateness. They think, just because I can do it, I should do it. And so they go ahead and use and abuse this wonderful and incredible power that they have at their fingertips, going out and making a total fool of themselves. And I think there's an important, very important point to make, is that the assumption is that in Second Life there's no consequences. You can just log out afterwards, right? You could just change your avatar name, change your preferences, and you know, whatever you do, there's no consequences. And I think there should be alarm bells ringing in your mind right away that, you know, as Buddhists, we know that you don't escape the consequences of anything. Any action you do has profound results on your own mind. Every word that we say, every action that we undertake, every time we undertake to hurt other people, to cause suffering to other people, when we fail to appreciate or to assign worth to other people who are being affected by our every action or every word, this is a karmic act, something which has great repercussions. So I think Second Life is a good example of a tool which, like any other tool, can be used and can be abused. And we really have to be careful. It's not just, I can, therefore I should. Can and should are two very different things. So this is using taints which are abandoned by using. So by doing this, we, as the Lord Buddha says, we get rid of many of the taints, many of these intoxications, many of the problems that we have in our mind. We become more sane and more sober. And moving on, then we get into the taints which are to be abandoned by enduring. And by enduring, which are the ones to be abandoned by enduring? This one sort of sets the tone very specifically for what Buddhist meditation should be seen as. And I think it dispels many of the myths of what Buddhist meditation is. It's not a vacation. It's not simply sitting there. Many people think of meditation as, well, then when you're going to meditate, you have to tell all your family to turn down the TV, don't bother me, don't make loud noise, close your door, sit in a comfortable chair, turn on the background music and the aromatherapy, and find bliss for a short time, so that you can then go out and fight with all the suffering and somehow be happier. And no, this is not how Buddhists approach meditation. Buddhist meditation is the enduring, the patience. It's having patience to deal with uncomfortable situations. So you can see this in meditation, according in this paragraph. In meditation, a bhikkhu, which means a monk or a meditator or anyone who sees the dangers in the rounds of rebirth and being born again and again, anyone who wants to be free from suffering, dangers in in the defilements. Bears, cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind and sun, and so on. And I had a personally had a very profound experience with mosquitoes that I always like to share with people. That I'm always reminded of at this point. And this is when I was first starting to meditate. I was told by my teacher that today I would have to practice in many different places. That I wasn't to practice only in my room. It's outside, inside, wherever I want. And of course, I guess he thought I was going to go and practice up at the meditation hall or at the pagoda or something. But I went and practiced right behind my kuti, right by the water, where the water flows through the rice fields. It was quite a peaceful place, but if anybody knows anything about rice fields, you know that it's a wonderful place for mosquitoes. They like it just as much as us meditators thought we would. And so sitting there, I first did walking, and that wasn't so bad. But then when I did sitting, they just started coming at me, one after another. And of course, mosquitoes had always been something that I was fine with, swatting, killing, hitting myself in the face as often as not, to get rid of. And so this was a real change for me, that I would now have to keep these moral precepts and would be forbidden to kill them, and instead had to sit there and endure them. And so they landed on me one by one by one by one. And after about the fifth one had landed on me, they were so quiet, and there was only this little tickle or a little bit of an itch. And so instead I focused on the itch and said, itching, itching. But inside of me there was this incredible tension where it just wasn't comfortable. It wasn't allowable. I couldn't allow this to happen. It was like, gotta get them off, gotta scratch. And after the fifth one landed on there, and I was started to really put my heart into a new way of looking at it, that my whole outlook on the situation changed. And suddenly this incredible relief surged through my body, and it was rapture and these wonderful, you know, very low-level meditative states. They're nothing special, but it was a special experience because it was a change in the way I looked at sentient life. You know, suddenly these were my friends, and they were all they wanted was some blood, which I had lots to give. Of course, I didn't know at the time that, you know, Thailand is very well known for its malaria problems, but it's probably a good thing that I didn't know. I was able to have this wonderful experience and I didn't die from it, so lucky me. But I think this is a good example, and it's these kind of things that we should sort of consider. I don't suppose it's a particularly good example as it stands, considering the malarial problem, and we're going to get into that in the next section. But the example stands that there are many things that are very uncomfortable and undesirable, and there's a reason for that, and it has nothing to do with the experience itself. The reason for that is solely set in our own minds. It's our own minds that create the discomfort, create the undesirability. It's making more of the situation than it actually is. And so the Buddha says, even feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life. It means you could even die from them. Not to give up, not to let them overcome you, not to let them win. To be able to endure even those. And this is a wonderful thing in meditation, when you're able to experience these incredible pains, back pains, neck pains, leg pains, head pains, and experience them in a whole new way, where suddenly it's fine. It's okay. They're just there. And then the wonderful thing is that they never come back after that. They never bother you after that. There's no more pain after that. It changes. It's a change in the way you look at things. It's not that somehow they go away. It's that there's no more bad. There's no more disliking. So this is number four. So here we have number five, the taints to be abandoned by avoiding. And this is sort of in contrast to the last one. So the objection which always comes up for the previous one, first of all, is that is it not torturing oneself? Is it not self-mortification to be always, you know, sitting through these things? And I think this is a pretty... It's a sign that the person has not really made a thorough study of Buddhism, because of course self-torture, self-mortification is specifically seeking out unpleasant situations, not bearing with them or enduring them. And so this is the answer is sort of found in this next one, where when it's a situation which is going to cause problems for you, like wild elephants, wild horses, and all of these things, wild people, snakes, stumps, bramble patch, chasms, cliffs, cesspit, sewers, etc. He avoids sitting on these things. So there's a story about a monk, and it was supposed to be a story of in the end it was, you know, very magical how it happened. He sat on this anthill, and he had made a determination that wherever he sat, he would not move from that spot. So he determined to just sit there. And, you know, he was able to get through it because he had this very strong power of mind. And the ants, he sent love to all of the ants and they didn't come near him. But this is the kind of thing that you should generally avoid when you know, because ants can be, you know, there's carnivorous ants out there in the jungles. So is this example of, you know, people who sometimes think you should just put up with everything, and when you see that something's, you know, maybe a very difficult situation, but all you have to do is move your seat and then there's no more problem. Now sometimes you have to see it as something that's going to bring difficulty to your practice. And furthermore, talking about people and association with bad friends, because when you associate with bad friends, then wise people will see you as the same, as being in the same vein, being of the same feather, so to speak. And so as a result of that, the meditator is able to be free from mental intoxication, that their mind is able to calm down and to settle down. Number six, we're talking about the taints to be abandoned by removing, and this is a very much a meditation teaching. And here we're talking about the states of mind which arise in meditation. When there arises greed, when there arises anger, and when there arises delusion. And I have to explain here the words used in the text. The first one is sensual desire. This is pretty easy to understand. This is states associated with wanting, with greed, with desire. But specifically desire of the senses, so wanting to see pleasant sights, wanting to smell pleasant sounds and tastes and feelings. Ill will is also pretty easy. It states associated with anger, aversion. When we're sitting and we don't like something, something makes us uncomfortable, unhappy. But the third one, cruelty, is it's a little bit hard to differentiate from anger. And actually that's not exactly the word. The good translation of cruelty would, of the word for cruelty, vihingsa, which means oppression. And it refers to states, that unwholesome states which arise based on delusion, based on conceit, based on views. When we hurt someone else, not because we're angry at them, not because we want something from them, but because we're conceited, because we believe ourselves superior to them. When we hold ourselves up, I'm higher than you, I'm better than you, you have to treat me like this, I get to treat you like that, and so on, then we do end up treating people in very inappropriate ways, and ways which lead to great discomfort for them and lead them to suffer based on our actions, not because we wished them harm, but simply because we had this ego get in the way of our relationship with them. And the same goes with thinking of ourselves as lower than someone, putting ourselves below people, thinking ourselves not worthy, and so on. And so a meditator doesn't tolerate these. And what does it mean to not tolerate them? But in meditation, actually, we try to be very tolerant. So what is meant here is we don't let them grow. We don't allow them to feed off of that which they're feeding off of. Because all three of these have an object. Any unwholesome state of mind has to take an object. Either it's something we see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we feel, and we think. And when we put our attention on that object, again and again and again, these states arise again and again and again. So when we hear something and we start listening to it and we get angry, then we listen to it more and we get angrier, and then we think about it and then we get angrier, and it builds up until we're furious. So in meditation, we're very tolerant of the actual mind state, but we're not tolerant of this cycle where we're feeding it. So we break the cycle and we tolerate it, but we tolerate only it. So if we feel anger, we focus on the anger and we say to ourselves, angry, angry. We have this mantra that we use to remind ourselves about the reality of it. And as we say to ourselves, angry, angry, we know that we're angry, but we've forgotten all about what it was that made us angry. And the anger no longer has food, it no longer has fuel. And the same with desire, the same with any kind of conceit or so on. So when we focus on it, then it's unable to feed. Either that or we focus on the reality of the object itself, and it goes away just the same. Because the fuel is not the object itself, it's what we think of it, and we're not giving ourselves the chance to make more of it than it actually is. So when we say to ourselves, seeing, seeing, reminding ourselves of its reality. And this is number six. And so as a result of this, of course, more of our unwholesome tendencies are rooted out. And finally, the number seven method, or the number seven way of looking at the abandonment of the taints or of the intoxications is this description of the path of enlightenment, or what it means to be enlightened, or how one comes to be enlightened, how one comes to attain enlightenment. And this is sort of a fairly deep, fairly advanced sort of teaching, if there actually is one. And so it's something that we can see from where we are and appreciate it, but it's of course much more important that we actually practice it. And if we're not practicing meditation, it doesn't really mean all that much. So what is it that we develop? What does it mean that to become enlightened? Well, you develop seven things, and these are called the seven factors of enlightenment. Of course, the first one is mindfulness. The first thing that we have to develop in our practice is the factor of mindfulness. Once we develop mindfulness, and of course, going back to my translation of the word, we're talking about reminding ourselves of the reality of the situation so that we don't make more of it than it actually is. Then we start to understand the reality of it. And this is what is called investigation of states. It actually means wisdom, or the discrimination, the ability to tell the difference between different mind states. And it simply means wisdom, the understanding which comes from being mindful. Understanding that all of the things which we're aware of, that we used to think were pleasant, that we used to think were controllable, that we used to think were satisfying and permanent and lasting and stable, we find that they're actually the opposite of that. They're not desirable, they're not pleasant, they're not satisfying, they're not permanent. And everything in our lives that we used to hold on to and say, this is going to make me happy, that's going to make me happy, if only I can get this, then I'll be happy. We give that up, and we let go of it. This is the we come to see that it's not what we thought it was. It's not something. It's suffering. It's something which can only lead to our suffering. Happiness is not to be found in anything in the world. It's to be found inside. And once wisdom starts to arise, so then it's just a matter of developing mindfulness and wisdom. But as you develop it like that, then certain changes overcome the meditator. The next one is rapture, that the meditator starts to get in the groove or starts to gain this sort of a charged state where you're really set and really just running around in the meditation. Your mind is not going anywhere. Rapture here means kind of like static electricity, a static charge to the mind. Or you can think of it kind of like getting in the groove where you're not falling away from the path, and so you're able to practice almost as if it's automatic. And doing this again and again and again, your mind starts to calm down. And these two are actually pretty dangerous ones for meditators, because when people gain states of rapture or states of tranquility or many other good states, which I'll probably be talking about in a later talk, we tend to associate with them and think of them as the goal. And so it's very easy to give up our practice at this point. If we're able to get over that, then we can move on and we come into concentration. Or if we're able to continue to be mindful, even in the face of great bliss and great happiness and great quietude of mind, then we come to the higher states, which is a state of concentration, where we're able to fix and to focus on the objects as they arise. We're able to see the objects of our attention arise and cease, come and go, you know, one by one by one. And we're able to see that there actually is no self, there is no I involved in the process. These things are not me, are not mine, are not under my control. And we're able to see them much clearer in a way that we wouldn't have ever thought possible, that is totally different from the way we appreciate the Buddha's teaching and not having practiced. And this in turn leads us to what is called equanimity. And this is to be distinguished, to be differentiated from the normal state of equanimity that we might be familiar with. And that is the equanimity which doesn't care and doesn't know and doesn't care, which is not really aware of the object. This state of equanimity is totally and fully aware of everything as it arises. But the things that used to make us happy and unhappy, the things that we used to jump out at, we used to cling to and strive for, they no longer have that power over us. And this is the highest state in Vipassana meditation. It's not yet enlightenment, but it's as far as Vipassana meditation goes. Because once you gain this state of equanimity, then the next step is enlightenment. The next step is freedom from suffering. The next step is the realization of Nibbana or Nirvana. And that, of course, is the reason why we're practicing. That, of course, means the extinguishing of the taints, the extinguishing of the intoxicating states of mind. And so as a result of doing this, of course, all of the taints, vexations, and fevers are gone. And so this is the talk on the sutta for today. And this concludes the discourse on the sabbasava, all of the taints. And so the Lord Buddha says, when the taints have been abandoned, then one is called a bhikkhu, then one is called one who sees the danger in the cycle of samsara, who dwells with the restraint of all the taints. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So I hope this has been useful and beneficial to all of you, or to at least some of you. And thank you for listening, and appreciate your interest in what I have to say, and I hope to have a chance to talk with you all about these things in the future. So thanks for coming, and that's all for today.